Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Resource Cast. I'm your host, John Varnker. Today, we're bringing you an interview with Kate Butcher, who is a very accomplished designer and a person who seems to be getting this freelance thing right. She's been doing it successfully for years. She has enough business that she can turn away work and clients that she feels doesn't work for her. And I think the key thing I took out of this conversation is that Kate runs her business like a true professional. She has terms and conditions she works under that include a 50% deposit before work is scheduled. Clients get a single revert built into their quote, and Kate makes a strong argument for how that saves her clients time and money. In this interview, we cover Kate's transition from agency to freelance work, her take on award shows like the Lurys versus smaller industry awards, juggling motherhood with her work, and a lot more. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, my guest today is Kate Butcher. She's a Cape Townian designer, illustrator, and owner of the Butcher's Shop Design Studio, which has been running since 2011. Kate has received almost ludicrously effusive praise from her clients, and which include phrases like, and I'm quoting here, one of the foremost talents we work with, a true professional, one of the most creative people I know, one of the best designers I've ever worked with, and a genius. All of those references are paired with mentions of her considerate, kind, and cheerful personality. I've got to say, I'm a little intimidated. Kate, thank you so much for being on the show.
I feel like I've paid those people.
I was wondering, because going through your references on your website, I was literally, I mean, I haven't seen that kind of effusive praise in references in a while.
Well, again, maybe I paid them. I don't know where that came from, to be honest. And also, cheerful personality is definitely not me.
Right. I could have been more the kind, considerate, but...
No, that's also not me.
Because I know your husband Anthony, and I think that you and he probably share a certain level of warm-hearted grumpiness or cynicism,
yes,
you might say.
Yes, definitely. He is definitely grumpier than I am, and I like people less.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so he's actually warmer on the inside, but
yeah, that's pretty much.
And you're colder.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so you run the Butcher's Shop, which is your little design studio, and you've been doing it for 9 years now. And you first trained, first of all, let's start at the beginning. How did you get into art in general? Did you take it in school? Was it a natural thing, or did you?
Yeah, I started messing around with paint and coloring in and all that sort of thing when I was really young. And my parents encouraged it just purely because it seemed like I had an aptitude for it. And then it was a natural thing for me to take art in high school, to choose it as a subject. And funnily enough, quite early on, my art teacher said to me, you know, you should look at doing graphic design. And I would say early on, probably like 7 or 9, because I would sit there and I would use PowerPoint or Word to design my projects. Obviously using the horrible clip art that they had, but I'm getting really frustrated because I couldn't move something in a millimeter.
Oh yeah.
To line things up. So
especially Word, where it snaps beginning of the end.
So I had no idea what graphic design was, and I just happened to go with two mates of mine to the Stellenbosch University
Open Day.
Right. Yeah. And they wanted to go look at that, and yeah, that's kind of how I got thrown into it.
And were you living in Stellenbosch?
No, so my parents live out in this tiny little dorp called Picketburg. Mm-hmm. And I went to boarding school in Cape Town. And then, yeah, when it was time to choose a varsity or whatever else, I decided Stellenbosch was a good fit, and my brother was out there already, so it all made sense.
Right. So you did a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Visual Communications, and then I think you do an Honours in Graphic Design?
Yeah, so it's a 4-year degree, so you have to do the Honours whether you right. like it or not.
Okay.
And yeah, that's pretty much what I studied.
So you didn't actually go to one of the kind of the ad schools, but you ended up at Draft FCB and then later Network BBDO. So how did you make that transition from a Fine Arts degree into marketing, essentially?
Okay, so... Stellenbosch University actually has 3 courses in the fine arts department. One of them is fine arts, one's jewelry, and then one is specializing graphic design. Mm-hmm. So although it's a fine arts degree, it's very much like full-on graphic design But what makes it interesting is that you get to do life drawing and illustration and that sort of thing. They're not so heavy on the Mac skills, so that right. you kind of end up having to teach yourself when you get a job. But I don't know, I had this idea when I was in high school that I wanted to make ads.
Right.
I didn't know how or why, but I had this obsession with print ads, and they were all over my walls. And I love TV ads, and I was like, oh, you know, one day I'll make those. But anyway, everything kind of, I ended up at Stellenbosch almost by luck studying graphic design. And I don't know, I knew from the beginning that I wanted to go into an ad agency. Okay. Like, I wanted a fast pace. I wanted something that would, you know, end up with, what's it called? Sorry, I've lost my train of thought. Yeah, I suppose I just wanted something that would challenge me, and I didn't want the norms. And I also liked the idea that advertising had awards. I was very much like an A-type personality. Like I.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, you know,
I'm, overachiever of note.
Well, I wouldn't say an overachiever. I was an underachiever at school, but when I find something I like, I need to win.
Right.
So I think advertising kind of suited me there. So immediately I knew that I wanted to go into advertising, and I wasn't going to do publishing or anything like that. I'm not that kind of designer. And I like to think and like to conceptualize. And that was something that came out quite strongly when I was studying, that I wasn't just, you know, there to draw or make things pretty. I wanted to have ideas.
Sure.
And that's why I decided that I would want to go into advertising. And when I first went to FCB, I actually went as an art director, because in my mind I was like, oh, well, you know, designers make things pretty and art directors are the ones that get to do things conceptually.
Right.
It was a blatant lie, but it's not really the truth. But yeah, so when I got to FCB, I was an art director and
you got,
fell into it.
And you kind of got thrown into the deep end there. I mean, we're talking early 2000s, yeah?
No, it was 2007.
Okay, right. So, okay. And you worked on, I mean, Draft FCB at that time was a
huge,
a bustling
yeah.
agency. So
yeah,
you must have
huge.
A lot of alcohol brands, a lot of
yeah.
work.
And I got thrown into FCB Impact, which was the fast pace section of the agency. Because I remember the guys from above the line, and they kind of stroll past you mm-hmm. at Hoppers 4 on the way home. And they'd get like, you know, 2 months to work on one TV ad. And here we were doing, I mean, the turnaround time was insane. And it wasn't to say that what we were doing was like fast track work. It wasn't that. It was just that it was a lot of promotions and whatever else. And whatever you did, there were 30 elements, and it had to get rolled out, and it had to be a concept and an idea. Yeah. So it was a great way to kind of cut my teeth in the industry, because I learned quite quickly what art direction was, and what was nice is I still got to do a certain level of design work because I was below the line, and I got to do a lot of my own illustrations, which was quite cool at the time. I mean, I hardly illustrate anymore, but when I first started, anything that I could get an illustration into, I would try and do. So
yeah,
any absolutely. Campaign. So that was, I mean, it was quite cool, and it was also a nice way to kind of get your head around the industry. Because we were a tight-knit bunch, and, you know, if someone needed to work till 4 o'clock in the morning, you would offer to help out.
Right.
Not that I'm any good past 10 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I'd be there as moral support.
Yeah.
And occasionally just, you know, start giggling or crying, depending on how late it was.
And you do, I mean, the sad thing is that you do get these 2 o'clock in the morning ideas that can turn into something great. But you have to kind of suffer through it.
You know, they say that, but I'm not that person.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I really...
Sadly, I am.
No, I'm a shocker. Like, for me, I work best from... I would rather wake up at 5 or 4 in the morning and work till 9 and then go to sleep.
Yeah.
That's working through the night thing, that it literally makes my brain explode.
Yeah.
So, I'm terrible.
Right. And that's something that the freelance lifestyle, in my experience, kind of entrenches even more, because I find it kind of once you get to 4 o'clock, a number of things happen. Either my wife comes home, the dog is now starting to get desperate for a walk, And that's why I tend to get up earlier and work when it's a bit quieter and then clock out a little bit earlier as well.
Yeah, I think life starts to happen, right? I mean, yeah. It's one thing if I was freelancing when I was 22, but freelancing now is very, very different. Like I have responsibilities. I can't be awake till like 4 a.m. and then still have to manage a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's impossible.
Yeah. So you went on to Drafts FCB. You were there for, I think, about 2 years.
Two and a half years.
Two and a bit.
Yeah.
And then on to Network BBDO, another, at that time, very fast-paced, happening agency to age myself with that saying. and then on in your LinkedIn, you described that as a metamorphosis. And I imagine that was going from kind of essentially graphic design art school into a very fast-paced advertising world.
So going to BBDO was a call because I wanted to go back into design. I realized that art direction wasn't for me, parts of it. I got bored. And I also realized that I don't really like working with lots of people, which is what pretty much an art director has to do, because
right. You've
got to, whatever you do, you're reliant on other people to help you make it work. Whether that is director or producer or whatever else, it's just there are too many people involved, and I'm a control freak, so it irritated me that things would not end up the way I wanted it to. And being a designer, I quickly realized it's a bit more of a speciality, so people take your opinion a bit better. I don't know, they follow your decisions, but better with art director, everybody wants to kind of get involved with those decisions.
Yes. I'm not sure if that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that designers created for themselves, because they tend to be much more reactive against anyone kind of leaning over their shoulder and telling them what to do. Whereas art directors, as you say, is much more of a team effort thing.
Yeah.
And that can end up being a slippery slope where suddenly everyone is giving you an opinion.
And that always just really irritated me. So yeah, I moved to BBDO to do design predominantly. It was a department of one, which was interesting. But it came with a whole bunch of, interesting projects, because it meant that whatever came into the agency that was design orientated, I'd be pulled in on it. So that was awesome. But it also meant that I ended up doing a bit more art direction than I was hoping to be doing. In terms of advertising life, I think you don't get more advertising than Network BBDO.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
Although I think you must have been coming in on kind of the tail end of the big parties, the crazy sociability.
I think for me, FCB was an interesting one because I drank the Kool-Aid. And I was ready to. I was like,
it's fun when you're young. It's
yeah. I mean, you're 22, and I loved socializing at the bar with people and just being around and doing what I needed to do. But I also believed in what we were doing. I believed in doing great work, and that was my passions, what I wanted to do. But I quite quickly realized when I was at FCB that the advertising life wasn't exactly fulfilling. I wasn't quite creating the work I wanted to create. I wasn't getting the, when I mean recognition, I wasn't getting to do the things I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I think when I left FCB, I was a bit disillusioned by the industry.
Did that change with Network?
Well, I got to Network.
Did it reinforce it?
In a terrible way, I got to Network, and I was already a bit jaded.
Mm-hmm. 2.5 years.
Only two and a half years.
I quit in two, so,
Yeah. No, so, and I got, when I got there, I probably didn't have the right attitude, to be honest. Hmm. And I think the type of agency it was probably not right for me. I think at that stage I needed somewhere probably quieter that was more design focused. That wasn't, I think from the beginning I knew that this wasn't going to be a long-term thing for me, but I wasn't quite sure what else to do.
Right.
Because in my mind, that's what advertising agencies were like.
Sure. So where to next?
Exactly.
So what was the chain of events that led you then to freelancing?
So I started dating my now husband, and he kept saying to me, "You're utterly miserable. You've got to move. You've got to do something." And I was miserable. I really, I, a big part of who I am is loving what I do. And if I'm not loving what I do every day, then what am I and what am I doing? How am I wasting my life? And so I started going for interviews, and I quickly realized, like, every interview I went for, I wasn't excited. I mean, even I went for an interview at, like, my ultimate agency when I was at Varsity. And I pretty much, it was a really good interview. And I walked out and I was kind of like, if I don't want to work here, then what am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, should I be leaving advertising? What should I be doing? And kind of decided as a, almost a stopgap really to kind of go freelance and just reevaluate what I was doing. And I was lucky because, I was 25 at the time. I didn't have a bond. I wasn't paying off a car. You know, if I ended up on the street, it would literally just be me. You know, it would be fine. Like, I called my
kids.
Yeah, I had no kids. Nothing to really worry about. I didn't even have a cat. I think I had lovebirds. I gave them back to my parents. Well, they gave them to me.
Wow, were you terrible, at the point where you said, you know what, I don't think I can handle the responsibility of two lovebirds?
Well, I will point out that my dad decided to give me the lovebirds when I was living in a bachelor flat, which was a serious fail parenting. I mean, it was a really bad idea. So yeah. I was like, you guys can have your lovebirds back. but yeah, so I kind of realized that if I was going to do something, it was the safest time to do it. And while I was kind of thinking about it, weirdly enough, my executive creative director from FCB messaged me and was like, have you considered freelancing? And he had just started Haas. So Glenn Fenter, he used to run Impact, he'd started Haas. It was supposed to be an advertising agency, I suppose, but with a new business model of using...
Yeah, it was a strange little...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have tried it. So bring in freelancers to do all the work so you don't have the overheads. Mm. But as with anything, that never actually works because you need people in the seats to do the work when you need it.
Right.
Anyway, so a writer and I, another girl that I used to work with at FCB, we both quit our jobs at the same time. And essentially went freelance. But what made it also easier is that Glenn was going to, we're going to work in his studio, pay rent on the desks. I mean, the first couple of months it was rent free. And he would pass on any work he had to us so that we knew that we had some new work. And yeah, it was a great safety net. Although looking back on it now, it wasn't actually a safety net because you never know what's going to happen.
Sure.
And what, I mean, it didn't end up working for us, for him or for us, because we got, you know, offered jobs we had to turn down on the possibility that he might have work for us. And it just became difficult to manage. But I mean, he was amazing. He really was. He helped us with all the random questions we had about freelancing because suddenly we had to run a business. I mean, we had no idea what we were doing. I had no idea how to deal with clients. I mean, at that stage, I was still pretty much a midweight.
Sure.
So he was amazing from that perspective. And also he believed in us, which also just helped the situation. So I think we rented space for about 6 months. And then we just realized, like, also it didn't really make sense because we most of the time didn't need to be at our desk. So why have one if you don't need to be there? So we started working from home. And Marcel, who was the writer that I was working with, we still work together today.
Is that the Marcel I know? What's his
name? She's now Warburg. It was Lang.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, no, different one.
Okay, so yeah, so Marcel and I have been working together on and off for like all 9 years.
Okay.
Actually, she lives down the road as well, so that also makes life really easy.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's how we went freelance. We just kind of...
Quite a nice, smooth little... like a bit of a transitional phase where you were working, you didn't go straight to working from home and some of the stresses that come with that.
Yeah, I was nervous too. I mean, also the thing is when you are, I knew at that stage that I was burnt out.
Like right.
I was tired. I was done. I wasn't earning very much. And that was another reason I could go freelance. Cause I was like, well, if I look at all I needed to do was to make my, salary from my previous job was to work, I think it was a week and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Hectic.
Yeah. So I was like, I mean, surely I can find work for a week and a half. Like,
yeah.
I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's disgusting to think about now. But yeah. So I could literally work 2 weeks of the month and I'd be good. Oh God, what was your question again?
It was just about the how the chain of events that led you to freelance.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I lost my train of thought.
I think we're there now.
yeah, we pretty much, that's pretty much how I ended up there.
So now, at this point, you've resigned, you've worked in the offices of Haas for a while, and eventually you decided to go kind of in-house. So when did you set up the butcher shop?
Oh, well, so now this is actually, so when I started, I've been freelancing for 9 years, the butcher shop's been around for those 9 years, but I wasn't necessarily focusing on it. Sorry, that's what I was trying to say. So I was getting burnt out working in an industry, and I knew that I didn't want to build up my own clients yet. I knew I wasn't ready for that. Like, yes, I could have a couple of clients on the side, which I did, but I didn't quite know how to manage them. But also the stress of it was quite hectic. So it's a lot to kind of take on it all at once. And I thought, well, you know, I actually just want to take it easy for a bit. I want to do a 9-to-5. So I started freelancing for agencies predominantly.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I probably did that for about 5 years. And I slowly built up my own clients along the way that I would do. I mean, sometimes I'd work for agencies 3 days a week. Sometimes it would be 5 days a week. Sometimes it would be like mornings. And then I kind of fit my clients in between. And it was a really nice way to kind of grow in the industry, but also get to know other people in the industry that I hadn't necessarily met yet working in the two agencies that I'd worked in. And also realizing that you have to love, I don't know, you just have to get to know every single traffic manager in the whole of Cape Town, and you're pretty much set.
Yeah.
So I worked in agencies for quite a long time because I wanted that 9-to-5. But then I started getting to the same point where, okay, I'm not burnt out anymore. I really want to actually do some really nice design work. And the problem with working in any agency is that you get called in to do pretty much whatever's available. And I got tired of doing that pretty much.
Did you tend to get the very worst of the jobs, or, because in my experience, it's not always like that. Sometimes you actually get a nice job.
Yeah, sure.
That's other people, because other people need they need people with context of the client to work on this bit.
Yes.
And now here's a pitch, or here's a brief that's a little bit out of the blue and is actually quite fresh. It's just, you know, and then you do end up with that stuff.
So it was an interesting one. I think it depends which agency I would go to. Some agencies I'd be a seat filler, mm-hmm. and I would just have to do whatever arrived at my desk.
Yeah.
You know, someone was on leave. The best jobs were when people who knew me called me in for specific things. So they knew I was really good at branding, or I liked packaging, or I was conceptual, and they had a brief that they knew I could do.
Right.
And those are always cool. It's also really nice to be called in on something that you know that someone believes you can do well and better than someone else. So that was quite nice. I hated working on pitches. I always thought like that was way too much stress.
Yeah.
And I worked on a couple, but I mean, generally, if I could avoid them, I did. It started off predominantly being in agency. And then I slowly built up my client base and I started shifting out of agencies. And what ended up happening is I had agencies who would call me and in for very, very specific niche jobs. And that was really cool. And I consulted like that for quite a while. And I had a rule that I wouldn't sit in agency.
Okay.
So, which also made it really interesting because I could work on a project basis and they would pull me in because they knew that I had no history of a client.
Sure.
So I had completely fresh eyes on something, which was really awesome. I did some like really cool work with King James and stuff like that, and Ogilvy and stuff. I really, really enjoyed that. But then you get to the stage where you're now building up more of your own clients and you realize, well, I can work for an agency at a reduced rate. And yes, I don't have to deal with the client, but you know, it's still a reduced rate.
Sure.
Or I can bill per hour and work with my own clients and make a lot more money. And do work that I can say that I want to do, essentially. I can say yes or no to it, right?
Sure.
And I suppose I got to a point where I was lucky enough that I could start saying yes or no to things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate dream of, any business in general, but a freelancer specifically, is when you have enough clients that you can get rid of the clients that are a problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, difficult clients. You tell them you have, you know, too much other work, can't take them on. And it's funny because it's not to say that I only work on like really exciting conceptual stuff. I don't. I have some bread and butter clients who are awesome to work with. I know that I can churn it out in a certain amount of time and that I'll get X income and it'll be fine. It's but I like working with them because they're good people and they're good clients and they pay on time and I can do the work fairly easily and I can spend, you know, a quarter of my day conceptualizing something that needs a little bit more thinking work. But then the rest of my day I can, you know, get on with just designing random things that need to get out.
Yeah.
So it's a nice balance. And I think you have to keep that balance because if I do stuff that's too conceptual for too long, it's too much pressure.
Right.
So I've got to have kind of a mixed bag of what I get to work on every day.
Yeah. I was having a, I was having a chat with Lucas yesterday. We recorded a bit about, how to know when it's time to go freelance.
Mm.
And part of that was, you know, was clients, when you're a freelancer, there are clients who have expectations of this is what I want.
Mm.
You don't have to go. It doesn't have to be a revolutionary thing.
Mm.
You know? And Lucas is a very, he's highly conceptual and his position was that of executive creative director. And he's always looking for the idea, no matter how pedestrian the job might be.
Sure. You know?
I tend to be a little bit more on the, some would say lazy side, but
practical.
Others would say practical
Let's
side.
Practical.
Practical. Where you know that the client is, they're looking for a Lego piece to fit the model that they're building.
Mm.
And they actually, that you don't need to knock it out of the park with something completely different. And that's that kind of that balance of work that's challenging because a lot of freelance, you know, is new and challenging. And then that work that is kind of comfortable and you know you can wax it is also great for me. I enjoy that.
No, I completely agree. And I also think, you know, like I said, you cannot be conceptual every day and do an amazing job. You can't.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have your off days. And on my off days, I plug my schedule full of things that I can churn out.
Right.
And I'm having a good day. I know I can.
How do you know?
When I sit down at my desk and I try to, like, I have a feeling when I just want to work on something conceptual.
Okay.
Like, you know, you get excited about it. If I'm not excited to sit at my desk, then I'm like, okay, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z today.
Sure.
Or if I'm really, really depressed with life, then I might do some admin.
Right.
Or if I'm really bad, I start cleaning my desk, which very seldom happens, but it happens.
But, I mean, by and large, having looked at your portfolio or your references, and you've got an award section on your website.
Yeah, no, it's an embarrassing one. I know it's for clients.
Well, that's interesting. I wanted to talk about that because you left kind of the ad industry as a full-timer in 2011. And then obviously you did work in agencies and I'm sure, and some of that work ended up going to award shows. But for most people, I think for most creatives, when they go freelance, the kind of awards shows end there. In your case, you've won awards for book design, beer and wine label design, and even judged for the Best Brand Awards in 2017. So that, what's your new kind of philosophy on awards? Is it just for clients? And how are the shows, because I chatted to Tessa about this as well, because she also put stuff into wine and industry awards kind of thing. So what is the difference between those ad shows versus something like the Lurie's?
Okay. I think as an HI personality, you're always going to want to win something, right? You want something shiny. But that's what I worked towards. I was fairly obsessed with it at when I was at FCB and at Varsity and whatever else, because I thought that that meant if someone gave me an award, it meant that I did well. And that would be the recognition I needed to be like, okay, I'm good. I did the job properly.
On a practical level, they were the building blocks of your career.
Yeah.
If you're in the agency system,
sure.
That's how you get new jobs.
Exactly.
Like, look at this gold lorry I won. Give me a job that pays better.
Exactly. Yeah. But I quickly realized, I think I've won my first lorry and I kind of had like this hollow feeling. And I realized that actually no matter what someone gave me to say, well done to you, like that would never be as good as the feeling of completing a piece of work that I actually really loved. And there were so many jobs that I'd entered that didn't come anywhere in lorries or wherever else and didn't make it any less good. It was, and I don't know, I think what I quickly realized, it was a very shallow way of judging your own work.
Sure.
And did it really matter? And did it make me happy or did it make my work better? It didn't.
Right.
So I don't believe in sitting up till like, you know, 11 o'clock at night in agency trying to come up with proactive ideas just so you can win an award. I'm not that creative.
Right.
Like, I think that's ridiculous. And to make your staff do it is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, you should get a random brief that arrives on your desk that no one else thinks is worth anything. And that's where you're going to find your reward.
Sure.
So that whole, I think that's why I say when I drank the Kool-Aid, like I was a believer.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've seen the light. So
But you have won awards as recently as 2019, right?
Yeah, no, totally. And I think I enter things now that are cheap to enter.
Yeah, because the industry specific awards, especially the wine and beer stuff, I mean those fees are what, 275
exactly.
rand or something.
It's
Lurie's is 2,000 or 3,000, I don't know.
Yeah, and I've considered it now and again and I'm actually like, well, how's it going to serve me?
Sure, because you don't want work from advertising agencies.
I don't.
So what's the point?
Exactly. So you know, the Beer and Wine Awards, I don't think it's a massive feather in my cap. They're slowly getting to a stage where I think the work's getting better. So I don't get an award like that. Actually, no, I just sound shitty. I kind of think... I enter that sort of thing because it's an awesome way to network and find new clients.
Right.
So, annoyingly, after winning the gold last year, I got a whole bunch of phone calls from people wanting me to work on new projects.
Okay.
But I just had my son.
Right.
And I was, you know, there's no way I was going to be working on anything. I think at the stage when they were calling me, I'd probably had a half an hour's sleep a day because Gray wasn't sleeping. So,
wow.
Yeah. It backfired in a weird way because all this work came my way and then I didn't get to use it.
Right.
Or get to do it. But yeah, I mean, awards, meh.
Yeah, no, I agree.
They look nice on your CV.
Yeah. But you've also picked up, what's interesting is beyond the fact that you still have kind of recent awards as a freelancer, which I can see must be, since your clients might be small wine labels, wine brands looking for a designer, I think that is actually a useful marketing tool because it gives them something to judge with, you know?
Totally.
As opposed to something as kind of generic as a Lurie Award, which is not relevant to them, you know? And a lot of your work is in branding and, you know, beautiful stuff for gins and wines and beers. And it's a little bit... Tessa Kleinfeld from The Resource works in a kind of a similar world, and she's very much about getting to use all the nice different papers and treatments and all kinds of like doodads that designers love. Are you also into that kind of crafty stuff?
I am. I love it, but I also lack patience.
Mm.
So, you know, I look at some of the work on shelf and I'm like, they must have had a client that had a lot of money to spend on beautiful papers, whatever else. Because a lot of the clients I get are smaller, and it's how to make their budgets work as best we can. So sometimes it's spending more time doing the design work and less money on the finish.
I noticed that in your portfolio, there was a branding job for Baxter's dog food, which in the blurb you talked about how it was very much a budget job, and that's why it's beautiful, but it's very simple, and it looks like that design could work on a sticker put on a paper bag. It could work on kind of any kind of budget-friendly format without a problem, and still look good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key. Is you kind of, funnily enough, that the client is someone I used to work with. And like when you know someone, you know that they don't have like a stash of cash and they're lying to you. You know what I mean? Like it's a startup. With any startup, you kind of, I know how I'd feel, and I wouldn't want to waste money on random things that people don't need. So I don't like to sell clients on things that I don't think is going to give them value.
Sure.
And if I can, I try to make it as practical as possible, because that's also our job. I mean,
yeah.
And I think that's
it's very much design thinking rather than art direction thinking, which is how can I go to Hawaii and shoot this ad?
Yeah, I think so. I quite like the idea of making something that's as simple as possible. So, you know, less packaging, less this, less printing needed, and just work for the client. I suppose it's solving the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So you actually have a couple of overseas clients. I mean, the only one that I can quote offhand is a Heroic Deli in Los Angeles. How do you pick up international work, and what are some of the pros and cons of that?
I've found working generally with international clients fairly tricky. If nothing else, just the time difference. So,
oh, sure. Los Angeles.
Yeah, jeez. My meeting's at 11 o'clock at night. It's not ideal, especially for someone like me who goes to bed at 9.
Right.
But it's a funny one because culture comes into it as well. Then there's a language gap. I had a Danish client who would I could speak to on the phone and be fine, but he'd write emails and I would have absolutely no idea what I needed to do. So, yeah, like the overseas clients have kind of, I think it's all connections that I've made in advertising that somehow know someone who knows someone who used to work here, right, who's now in an island or now in the UK or wherever. And that's how I've kind of picked up those ones. And then I've had a couple of, I suppose the nice thing about going to somewhere, studying somewhere like Stellenbosch is being exposed to a whole bunch of people who essentially go out into the world and start their own businesses, right?
Sure.
But know nothing about marketing.
Yeah.
Or nothing about design. And the only thing that they know is they have a mate who they used to have a drink with at Terrace, who now is a graphic designer. It's quite cool. So I get a lot of phone calls from like random friends from 10 years ago who go, I've started a yachting company,
right,
and I need a logo.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great.
Oh, I can... That's a dream.
Yeah, no, totally.
Is that a real example?
Yes, that is a real example.
Yachting. That's yeah, the place to be for design.
No, totally. And that's the thing. It's like these random, it's amazing what you kind of, if you open yourself up to things and you start talking about things, what comes your way. And that's why I think it's so important that I haven't done it in ages and I want to kick myself, but post things on Facebook, post things on Instagram, show people what I'm doing, because that way I actually get the clients I want versus just any random person.
Right.
Because when someone thinks I need a logo done, oh, I know Kate does that. Or
yeah. And you want to kind of create you create your own funnel where you show off the work that you like to do.
Exactly.
And hopefully get more of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Without getting pigeonholed into, oh, you're the calligraphy lady or whatever.
Totally. I think it's, and I mean, I am quite careful that I don't become just the logo person.
Yeah. But even within logos, your range is very wide. It's not.
Yeah, I've been lucky because I've done so many different industries and each one you have to treat slightly differently. But it becomes very interesting. I mean, especially I've done a lot of hotels and hospitality recently. But at the same time, I've done lots of finance brands, and those are very, very different. So,
totally.
You know, it's like anything that kind of comes up, I get excited about. Yeah. It doesn't really matter what it is.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go into a quick little, take a break with a little segment here. It's called These Are a Few of My Favorite Things, sound effects. So basically, what nice little effect or trick do you love that you can share with the audience? Some kind of shortcut or app or something you do that kind of helps you be more efficient or get work done better or whatever it might be?
It's a tricky one. I would probably say the one that probably comes up the most is icons. It takes a while to develop a decent icon, but when you've got a client who doesn't have the money to pay for that icon development, or just literally needs something quickly thrown in a corner, my favorite place to go is Favicon.
Okay.
Yeah, I go on there, and then they've got a whole bunch, so I can either modify it or I can use it as is, and it's just a really, I mean, it's a free tool because, I mean, who has the cash to go develop a whole bunch of icons for, or not even a whole bunch, just one or two icons that they need
for generic things.
Exactly. Like a smiley face. I mean, I don't want to spend half an hour doing a smiley face when I can just get one.
Sure.
Unless of course it's going to become the smiley face that goes on absolutely everything that they do.
Sure.
And our clients understand that as well. So, you know, if I'm dealing with a client that is looking for a set of icons, I will go and develop them a set of icons.
Of course.
But if I've got a client who needs signage that has got, you know, don't shake hands with someone because of the coronavirus, which I literally have that brief in my email.
Oh,
I'm just going to go and grab something off Favicon, and you know.
And is it a free resource? Or is there a kind of an upgraded version?
I think there is an upgraded version. Some of them aren't free that you have to pay for, like considered premium. But there's more than enough on there to kind of keep you going.
Right. You're the designer. I noticed looking through your portfolio that you're the designer behind the new Mitchell's Brewery branding, which is beautiful stuff. And Old Wobbly is my favorite beer. In your write-up about the project, you said you were asked to tread a line between too crafty and too mainstream. With the explosion in craft everything seeming to have reached kind of peak levels now, how do you do something stand out in a crowd like that, especially kind of beer and wine? And what are your thoughts on the level of design kind of in the craft beer and wine, well, in the beer and wine industry? Because you see a lot of very twirly moustache stuff.
Sure, yeah.
It does seem to
very
be...
very hipster.
Yeah, everyone went very hard on hipster, and now it's... I'm seeing more variety, but it is a very, very crowded market now. So what do you think is in the current market? Are there any kind of guidelines for... Well, guidelines, any ideas you have for standing out? Is it simplicity? Is it complexity? Is it craft?
So I think for me, when you're looking at anything on a shelf, it's always what's going to stand out. And funnily enough, my brain always goes simplify. Because as soon as you have anything that's too complex, when you're looking at an entire shelf of wine or beer or whatever else, that's going to recede. So I think if you look to my website, most of my packaging is really actually quite simple, and there's big white spaces or big black spaces. Because that draws the eye in, or something bright or colorful here or there. So, I mean, when it comes to Mitchell's, it was such an amazing brief because they kind of gave me free rein.
You'd redid their logo, updated.
Yeah, I mean, it needed a lot of love. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the old stuff, but it hadn't been changed since 1946. So,
yeah.
It was a cool project to work on from that perspective. And then because it essentially is the oldest craft beer in South Africa,
right.
They just missed the craft beer boat.
It's a bit like Fireman's Arms, you know. It's like
totally
the pub that's always been there, so it never decided to get onto the gastro pub thing.
So I mean, I think I'd read it in end of 2016, beginning of 2017, somewhere around there, and I pretty much looked at the shelves or what was on the shelves at that time, and everything was hipster.
Right.
There were lots of illustrations. It was all beautiful. And believe me, I bought a whole bunch of it, and it's sitting on my shelf upstairs. But I kind of wanted to create something that looked slightly different but had cues of a traditional beer, especially because Mitchell's is an established beer.
Sure.
So it had to kind of play with both. And then it has all this like rich heritage and whatever else. And I'm a huge, massive fan of anything that's geometric. You probably noticed that everything.
I can see that, yes.
Everything is geometric that I do. I can't help myself. I mean, even the pillows in my house are geometric.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's a problem. I wanted to create something that was really clean and simple, had a concept, but then also just stood out amongst all this other clutter.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, I know that a lot of the beer market's struggling at the moment. So it has quietened down a little bit in terms of numbers. And I think Jen is the same. It's kind of, there's just too much out there.
Yeah. I think the place down the road has got something like 600 gins or something.
Yeah. The Liquor City. It's amazing. I go in there and I just stare at labels. It's kind of awkward.
Yeah. It's like the Pinterest of gin.
They're like, do you want to buy anything? No, I'm just here to look at your beautiful labels.
Absolutely. Well, I'll put a couple of shots of the Old Mitchell's branding on the Instagram page. You'll see the geometry, and you'll see very quickly the concept coming through in very simple design. Like the milk and honey, it looks like the hexagonal bee...
Hive,
yes.
Max.
And thanks for that. I'll throw that up on the Instagram. What have we got next year? Okay, so in looking through doing my research, I kind of came up with a new idea for a segment, which is called Terms and Conditions Apply.
Oh, God, okay.
So unlike many creatives, you have a Terms and Conditions section on your website. I'm guessing that some of these were written because of an experience you had with a project or a client. In this segment, I'm going to read them out, and you explain the story or the reasoning behind them. And for those of you who are listening, you know, it might be a good idea to start thinking about these things in terms of what you give to a client in terms of your expectations for payment, for who owns the work and for how long and all that. So let's start with number one, cost estimates. You've got cost estimates are valid for 30 days from creation. The cost includes one revert, after which you will be billed per revert and charged at an hourly rate. The estimate is subject to the client supplying suitable content and imagery. Any meetings or additional copywriting, photography, illustration, or image editing required to complete this project will be charged for at an hourly rate. Payment terms are a 50% non-refundable deposit payable before work will be scheduled, and the balance is due within 5 days of completion of the project unless negotiated otherwise. A 50% rejection fee is covered by the deposit. So I'm guessing scope creep is what that is there to prevent, extra work that has not been quoted for that creeps in.
And I think the problem there is, as creatives, we just want to give, give, give.
Yeah.
And clients just naturally want to take, take, take. Sure. And the more you give, the more they'll take. And then it becomes expected. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, we shoot ourselves in the foot. So I think that was probably the first bit of terms and conditions I put on. And it's been refined over 9 years. But the crux of it was that if you don't say 30 days, in a year's time, a client's going to expect that same cost. And it's not going to happen. You know, your costs would have gone up. Everything would have changed.
The one revert is particularly interesting because I think I work on a kind of a two or three revert thing, probably two. And do you stick to that quite hard?
I do, because what I've realized is for me to give a client two or three reverts means that I've got to build those hours, those possible hours, into my fee from the beginning.
Yeah.
They might not use that time. So essentially they pay for me to twiddle my thumbs. And I don't think that's number one fair. Mm. And when my clients question me on the one revert, I explain that to them and they're like, oh, actually fair enough.
Sure. And you're training them to get all their feedback together
and be responsible about it, right? Exactly, yeah. You know, there's nothing worse than dealing with a committee of five people and they each send you changes. It doesn't work for me. So, the other thing with the one revert is that, actually, what is the thing about the one revert? It's not only them.
The planning obviously helps.
No, but you know, it's also a case of, I think the more specific you can be, like I hate the feeling that I'm being taken advantage of, or while I'm doing something, feeling like I'm being taken advantage of. So making stuff really clear, like one revert, it means I never get to that stage. And if a client asks me, oh, can you make this little tweak? I usually do it. It's not a problem. But when they start asking you for something that's going to take you 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, that's when you have to kind of like, actually, no. So sorry. But I mean, I'm strict with it, but I do not consider something that's going to take me 5 minutes a revert.
A full revert.
No.
Sure. Absolutely. Like this is a typo or the details are wrong on one particular thing and all that. Yeah, absolutely. And then in terms of, you've got a payment terms condition here, which is a 50% deposit payable before work will be scheduled and the balance due 5 days of completion of the project. With smaller clients, I imagine that can be mostly okay. I've been in situations where I've worked for corporates where they have the most insane payment standards and they just say, well, that's the way it is, 90 days or whatever it might be. Do you flex on that? You don't tend to work with those people probably.
Yeah, I mean, I'm relatively flexible, but funny enough, I have not had a problem with the 50% deposit or, you know, payment on a certain amount of time. I generally don't have an issue with it. And I think, you know, you can't not, it's funny because I know a lot of freelancers who don't request a 50% deposit because they're like, oh, I know the person. So I know I'm going to get the money. I'm like, fine. But it's not actually also about that. It's about, you know, making sure that you have cash in the bank. So asking for that 50% upfront isn't necessarily just a safety measure. It's making sure that while you're working on the job, you've actually got income. So that when you get the next 50%, like, you know, it just rolls on. So you constantly have an inflow of income.
Right.
And the 5 days, it's fairly negotiable, but I mean, again, I don't really have a problem with it because the clients know that I like to get paid in a certain amount of time. the bigger companies, I know that they have generally have a payment run once a week. So the guys who sell me that they can only pay me in like 60 days, I'm like, well, then sorry, I can't do the job because it's quite simple. These are my payment terms.
Sure.
And like I said, I haven't had that problem. I think the only places that have given me like a month is agencies. And then it's generally fine because you're going from one agency to another, and you know that you're going to have that set work.
Yeah, it's kind of a paycheck.
So. It's exactly a paycheck. So, I've always just thought it was really important to get that 50% up front. And it doesn't matter from who. Like, there are a couple of clients that I now work with, that I've been working with for so many years, that I just bill them. They don't even ask for a quote. I just bill.
Right.
So I don't ask for a deposit or anything like that. But when it comes to logos or actual projects, I mean, even actually with those clients, if it's a project and we've scoped up everything beforehand and it's going to be big, they pay a deposit.
Right.
Because I have no idea how long it's going to take to complete.
Right. So you charge, do you predominantly charge on a project fee, not hourly or daily rates and that kind of thing?
It's such a difficult one. It's such a debate because it kind of depends on client to client and job to job. So logos and CI guides, I have a set fee because I know, I've done so many of them, I know how long it's going to take me. So that's a set fee. But other work is per hour because it's brief. I mean, one catalog for one client is going to take me longer than another catalog for another client.
Sure.
And it depends on what the requirements are. So that's very difficult to scope beforehand on a project fee. And then I don't like the idea of project fees because I worry that a lot of clients say, okay, I want a project fee and I want all my reverts included. Because again, you have to balloon the quote so much for any possible eventuality. It becomes so tricky.
Sure.
So.
And if you don't know the client that well, then you kind of have to bet on them being unreasonable in the amount of reverts and amount of work those reverts might have.
So, I mean, I suppose in some ways I do give people a project fee in terms of here's the project, this is how many hours it's going to take. But I have so many terms and conditions that it never puts me in a position where if they come back with reverts that I'm stuck.
Yeah. I think that one revert rule is something to think about. And I think I'm going to think about it personally because the unknowables of a project scope really lie there.
Yeah.
If they've given you a brief, if they've given you the information they want and the deliverables, with a bit of experience, I think you can mostly hash out how long you estimate it's going to take. But the unknowables are how many times is this going to come back? Are they going to change it? I'm just busy rewriting a whole script that I've already finished recording day later. Oh, actually, we're changing the whole thing. Haven't recorded yet, have you?
Oh, God.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a good little rule to consider. And I think the difficulty there is if you need to retrain the clients you already have. I think that's probably quite a challenge, is if your clients have already learned bad habits, trying to get them to unlearn them might be tough. Have you ever had to do that with anyone?
I've had that rule for so long that I haven't.
So the easiest time to start is 10 years ago, but the second easiest time to start is now. So even if you maintain the way you're working with your clients now, your current clients, but when new clients come in, set new rules. They're not going to
Never know.
Exactly.
They will never, ever know.
Yeah. Right. Next, print work. Please note that a 20% markup is placed on the print costs of all jobs that will require project management, and a 10% markup is placed on all image purchases and will be invoiced accordingly. So that sounds like admin fees, essentially. It's quite a lot of work to organize. You have to email printers and
people
all that
don't
stuff.
Realize how much of an effort it is to deal with print stuff. And also, I mean, it's a liability. Like, I really hate dealing with print production.
Right.
There's so much that can go wrong. Yeah. Again, my control freak comes out.
Yeah.
So it's just making sure
especially
it's worth
your
high
while. Value, detailed, exacting design, like label design.
But also the thing is, a lot of the time, so for example, on like agencies make a lot of their income off their 20% markup on print costs. Now, none of my clients are big enough to really, for me to make a decent profit off it. But it just makes sure that whatever time I've spent is paid for, essentially.
Hmm. Ownership. All artwork remains the property of the butcher's shop until payment is made in full, at which time the proved artwork becomes the client's property, while the concept artwork remains the property of the butcher's shop. The butcher's shop also retains the right to use all work, approved or otherwise, in their portfolio. The two key things there are you retain the concept artwork, and I assume that's to stop them from developing ideas, you showed them that they decided not to go with for a final version.
Yeah.
And then the second one being that you have the right to use it in your portfolio, because a lot of people have a lot of work that's under some form of NDA or is an internal piece, and the client will tell them, no, we don't want that. How much work do you get from clients who tell you, no, we don't want this to be public?
So I've had two clients. So one client was an agency in Ireland who didn't want their client to know that they were outsourcing.
Right.
So that work I've never posted anywhere. Hmm. Another client wanted me to do stuff for them, and I turned down the work because they wouldn't let me put it in my portfolio, because again, they didn't want their clients to know that they could essentially outsource to me rather than.
Right. I see.
Yeah. So that becomes tricky. But funnily enough, this ownership thing really came out of the resource, because there was someone posted something about a client wanting to use a second concept that they had done, because after a year they decided that they didn't like the first one.
Right.
Something like that.
They want to use it but not pay the freelancer to develop it.
Well, for that development. And that's the thing, is like, yes, you've paid me however much time, because when I do a logo, I come up with three options, at least. You've paid me time to do those three options, but you've actually paid to use one of those options.
Sure.
So, no, those other two you don't own them. And in terms of using stuff in my portfolio, I mean, it's mine, so.
Sure. And also, I think that in general, the work that you do is not some of that NDA stuff.
No, it's not. It's not.
Yeah.
It's
very public and going on to packaging a lot of it.
It's generally fine. I mean, and that's the thing, like the client that wanted me to work on packaging, essentially, that they didn't want their clients to know I was working on, and I completely understand why.
Sure.
It makes complete sense, but that just doesn't work for me, because that's my advertising, right?
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I'd rather spend that time on other stuff.
Yeah. Your last T's and C's here is the approval of the quote means the above is agreed to. So
you know how many people don't actually read the T's and C's? It drives me insane. New clients, I send my quote. And I always say, please read the T's and C's and ask me any questions you might have.
Right.
Because they suddenly come back, what do you mean there's only one revert? And what does a revert mean? And you're like, well, you should have asked these questions before. So I think that's essentially what I've learned, is just if everything's down on, and that's why I also am a huge fan of email, because it's a paper trail, right?
Sure, yeah.
Anything that's spoken about on the phone, I then reiterate, put back into a mail and say, just to confirm this is what we've spoken about.
Right, yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, because I haven't had a bad experience with a client who hasn't paid for a long time or has become, you know, fractious relationship or anything like that. But what I'm hoping to find out through these podcast episodes is, some people seem to just have no problems and some people have nothing but problems.
Mm.
And I don't yet know what that indefinable thing is. A lot of it, I think, is about setting boundaries.
Mm.
But I feel like there are other elements too. Some people end up with a lot of drama with their clients and some people don't. And anyway, it's interesting to try and figure out like what those elements are.
I think it's definitely got to do with what you'll put up with and what you won't. But I also, funnily enough, I think it's, you've got to have a bullshit meter.
Mm-hmm.
So when you meet that client and something in the back of your mind goes, something's not right, just walk away.
And your tactic there is, I'm sorry, I'm actually too busy for this project right now.
Yeah, it's not a good fit for me, you know.
Do you recommend someone, or have a bad feeling?
If I've got a really bad feeling, but also, I mean, you'll know, someone sends you a brief and it's all over the place. You're like, this is not the kind of client I want to work with, because they're not clear on what they need and what they want.
Sure.
And it's not to say it's not someone who understands, you know, I only work with people who understand marketing and know how to write a brief. It's not that. It's, you kind of get a sense of, they know what they essentially want.
Yeah.
And you get a sense of if they're a good person or not. And I know that sounds weird, but like, I think it's just like, if you get any feeling that this is not going to end well, then walk away.
Yeah.
Because it's not worth your time. Even if you're desperate for the cash, it's just kind of like something else will crop up that will be a lot less pain.
Sure. So you've been making this work now for about 9 years. What has been the secret of your success, would you say?
I think probably time management. I know a lot of creators who procrastinate. I'm quite anxiety driven, so
powered by anxiety.
That's exactly it. I mean, like, you know, a lot of people are like, "Oh, but how do you get up in the morning to go and get, you know, start work?" And I'm like, "Well, if you can just stay in your PJs." And I'm like, "Because I need to get that work out. Like, I have emails that I need to respond to." I mean, I got to the stage where when I first started freelancing, I was so anxious that I had clients who would message me at 11 o'clock at night and I would feel like I had to respond.
Yeah.
Like, it freaked me out completely. So I've dulled down on that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think the reason it's worked is I communicate with my clients, not always brilliantly, but I get back to them, and it's bizarre how many freelancers don't. And, you know, I make sure that I sit at my desk for 8 hours a day and I get the work done.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, I think that's the main thing.
A professional, which is definitely something that came out of your references as well, is just that, and I've worked with a couple of freelancers who stand out head and shoulders above other people just because they act like professionals. I'm not particularly good at it. I tend to get far too familiar far too quickly when it comes to clients that become bros and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's also not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because, I mean, you have to client service.
Sure.
And I think that's also what a lot of creatives don't do, is you've got to nurture a relationship, because it doesn't matter how good my work is, actually. It's about the relationship I build with my client. They trust me. They know they get the work on time. They know what I'm talking about. It's so many of my clients don't actually care about the finer details of things that I sit there for hours crafting. It's more about, and a lot of my bigger clients, you know, they work in, for example, hospitality. If the marketing manager goes on leave, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to carry on getting the work, because she is my contact.
Right.
So you've got to maintain relationships and build the relationship around just that one person. So you've got to get to know the other people in the team. And
yeah. Do you have any kind of CRM or keeping in touch with clients who you haven't heard from in a few months? You drop them a line and say, "Hey, how's it going?"
You know, I used to, but I think I've been fairly lucky that I'm fairly busy that I don't need to kind of, "Where are you? What's going on?"
Sure.
Every now and again, yeah, sure. Like if it's a client that I know something's going to be coming up or whatever, I'll be like, "Oh, so what are we doing for this? Or is everything cool? Everything okay?"
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, most of the time it kind of just, I get to the point where that person's quiet and I'm quite enjoying the fact that they're quiet because I'm quite busy.
Yeah.
So the problem is when they all decide to suddenly need work at the same time. That's
right. So you and your husband, Anthony, have a son named Gray. Is he about two now? Or
he's 18 months next
18
week.
Months.
Yeah.
Okay. I've seen Anthony's WhatsApp profile pic, which I believe is a design you did, portraying Gray as a Godzilla-like monster,
yeah,
wrecking your home, life, and world in general.
Totally.
So what's up with that?
I think as a control freak, having a child kind of throws everything off kilter.
Right. Yeah.
And he is an awesome little creature, and he can be a monster. You really can.
Mm.
So especially working from home, I've had to kind of reevaluate my space entirely, because I am an introvert. I like quiet time. I like time to recharge. And since having him, I've now got a little creature who was pretty much attached to me solely for like 6 months. And suddenly had to have a nanny in a house that's busy all the time.
Sure.
And picking up and dropping off and doing this and taking to that. And
it's a juggling job that I've yet to climb into the circus ring. I'm in June, Sally's giving birth, so we will be having a little boy as well. So any words of advice for balancing a freelance career and a new baby? We're both going to be working from home, which is
I think team.
Yeah.
Teamwork. Yeah. Try and get as much sleep beforehand as possible. I think
everyone says that, but you can't bank sleep.
No, you can't bank, but I wish you could.
Yeah.
I would definitely go get some of that if I could. I think Yeah, trying to freelance with children, boundaries. I think you quite quickly realize what's important. I used to spend a lot of extra hours and weekends working, not necessarily because I needed to, but because I wanted to get things right. And I think once you have a kid, you kind of put things in perspective and you realize that, I think like anything else, like work is not the be all and end all. So yeah. Yeah, he comes first in everything and I kind of work around that.
Sure.
I suppose that's a lot of reasons why you will not find, you generally don't find mothers in advertising.
Well, it's too all-consuming.
It is.
And it's like having two children
same time. Well,
I'm glad we're not having twins, let's put it that way.
Well, I think it's more like having two families with kids in both those families.
And okay, that's about as terrifying as I think it is,
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. So, yeah, no, he's been a lot to kind of get my head around, but he's been pretty awesome at the same time.
I guess a kind of a side effect, though, coming back to time management, is that you must have become even more efficient now. You must be...
No.
No? Okay.
Because if I'm managing my time, I can plan ahead.
Right.
I cannot plan for if my child decides not to sleep or to sleep or when to eat or not to eat or to feel sick or not to feel sick. So I've had to let go a lot of my own control things.
Sure.
It hasn't always worked very well trying to do that or get my head around it. But I think that with a kid, they're a whirlwind. You can't plan.
Sure.
You can't. I mean, there are those people who have their kids stuck to a schedule and they do exactly as they should, like per the schedule. And my kid is not that kid. So massive fan of a schedule, just haven't been able to implement it.
But I guess you do cut away. You mentioned that you're not really into social media. So, I mean, that is a massive time suck that you don't. Look,
no, I mean, when you say I'm not into social media, Gray has his own like Instagram page.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
No, okay. He does. It's closed to the public, but it's there. So he gets Instagrammed a lot.
Right.
And I think my personal profile, I Instagram a lot. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to the rest of social media, Twitter and can't be asked, and TikTok and those things I do not understand. I'm too old.
TikTok's an interesting one. I think I actually am looking forward to interviewing someone in like a Gen Z creative. Because I've spent a bit of time on TikTok trying to understand it and I kind of get it.
But you're kind of like, why?
Well, I think I know now why, but it is both a great opportunity for creativity and also at the same time just the most horrific thing in the world. But so is Twitter and so can Instagram be.
Sure.
I think it's got all those advantages and foibles of other channels. It's just much more, it's deliberately designed to be impenetrable to anyone over 25. Although you do see an increasing number of 30 and 40 year olds and they've got hashtags for TikTok over 30 and 40 and all that kind of thing. And I'm sure they're out to be the cool older people on the platform.
Yeah.
And I'm sure sometimes it works, but in general, it doesn't.
I'm not an early adopter at all, and I'm falling behind in a big way.
Yeah.
So, and I'm okay with that.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm totally actually okay with that.
Well, in the case of TikTok, I don't think it's going to affect your career. Okay. Let's start wrapping up towards this rapid fire round. So a few just kind of quick short questions. So number one, we know you work from home. Where do you work? Do you have a studio? Do you work?
I have a loft. Yeah.
I saw the loft. I saw a standing desk from outside.
Well, that's Anthony's standing desk.
Right. Does he ever use it?
Thankfully not. I struggle having people in my space. No, he very seldom uses it. And yeah, I have my loft upstairs and thank God I have an aircon.
Yeah. That upstairs must get crazy.
Yeah, like 45 degrees.
Yeah. Do you in your mind have a personal brand? Anything that you consciously develop?
In what way? Like as myself?
Yeah, when you present yourself to clients, do you in your mind say, and it might become
put on my game face.
Yeah, do you have a game face essentially?
Yeah, it's that sparkly personality that they spoke about in my recommendations.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't
yeah.
actually exist. Wow. Right. I'm smiling and
I can see behind it. There's nothing, though.
Yeah, no, totally. It's just like cold eyes. Yeah, I think everyone does. I don't think you can possibly do what we do and just, I think you have to put on a game face.
Well, there's a layer of professionalism, certainly. But then I guess another layer would be if you, when I'm talking about personal branding, have you ever kind of sat down and kind of, I want to be an authority on branding or logos or this type of design, and I'm going to portray myself in that way?
Yeah, look, I think it's happened naturally. I cast my net quite wide in terms of the things that I've offered, especially, for example, on my website. And I have culled probably 70% of that. And I kind of know now that it's the things that I like to do, but also the things that people come to me for, which is predominantly branding and the ways that that rolls out.
Sure.
So, I think that's why I end up doing so many logos, so many like packaging jobs, but I also relook a lot of CIs. A lot of companies come to me and say, well, this is what we're doing. Is it right? How can we do it better?
Yeah.
Funny enough, that's a lot of work that's been coming my way recently.
There must be quite a lot of older companies that their logo is no longer appropriate for specifically social media, but digital in general.
Yeah.
It's just not built for the formats aren't correct.
Or they're just really ugly. I mean, that's another thing. Like someone designed them in paint and they thought it was a great logo at the time. And I mean, the couple of those that have come my way, or the client has actually drawn something and just got a designer to, you know,
outline it and
turn it into a vector. And that's
don't,
the logo.
Don't change it too much though. I love it.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly it.
It
happened naturally, really.
What would your advice be to new graduates leaving Stellenbosch University, AAA, Vega, Red and Yellow? Obviously, it's in a world that you no longer kind of, because you have gone into agency life out of studying, what would your tips be for those who are doing that? And I do think that most people
would go into
a job and then into freelance. So,
I think the world has changed quite a lot. Whereas when we, and this is what a career director said to me, we were lucky to work in those places. I think that sentiment has changed in agencies. So I think a lot of students are kind of going in, I think, better with their heads screwed on properly this time around, kind of going, okay, well, actually, I'm here to do work. I don't have to thank you for it.
Yeah.
But I think going into an agency, get a feel for what you're doing and don't think that it's the only place you can go with your skills is essentially it.
Yeah.
Especially in design, actually. I think art direction, you're a little bit more pigeonholed into working, whether it's at an agency or in-house. But as a designer, I mean, essentially you are a problem solver. So whether you are solving a marketing problem or you're designing burglar bars, like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's so many opportunities. And sorry, I say burglar bars because I've designed burglar bars for our house.
I was going to say, I'm sure that must be an awesome brief.
Yeah, it was a brief from my husband because we really had ugly burglar bars. So it did take me 2 years to implement. But I think that's the thing, is like you to become an entrepreneur, because you cannot rely on other people in the agencies, especially to make you feel fulfilled or to give you what you do.
Yeah, or look after your best interests, really.
No, they definitely won't, and you can understand why they don't. So it's a case of learning what you can and then making your own way.
Yeah, I definitely found towards the end of my agency days that a lot more of the younger guys coming in were looking at agencies as a stepping stone to the next thing. Or at least they weren't thinking, I'm going to be an ad man.
Oh, thank God.
Because that's kind of dead now, which is totally fine and dandy.
Yeah.
Because it was, I mean, the old school advertising world that I came into back in very early 2000s, 2003 or four, it was the tail end of the charismatic dictatorial creative director, the massive levels of misogyny, the drunkenness, all the ridiculousness, you know. And it's become a lot less fun now, but it's also a lot less kind of exploity in my mind.
Yeah, I think.
Or at least, as you say, the kids have their head screwed on
the right way.
Better,
hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Do you use a tablet or any specific tools in your work that help you work faster or better?
Yeah. So it took me a while to move on to it, but I've got a Wacom Intuos Pro. I cannot tell you how it works exactly. It has a whole bunch of buttons I never use.
Mm-hmm.
I've been meaning to do a tutorial on exactly how this thing works and to work it out properly. But yeah, it makes my life it makes my life easier, especially when it comes to drawing and that sort of thing. So it's been awesome. But it probably is too much machine for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, often, I mean, if you look at something like Photoshop, it's too much program for pretty much anyone.
I keep finding new things in design and Photoshop I never knew was there. And I keep wondering if they've just introduced it or if it's been there since the beginning and I just haven't found it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Or whether you've just been staring at an icon for 10 years and like,
not wondering what it is. And then every time I find a shortcut, I'm just like, oh my God, this makes my life so much easier.
You click on one of the tools and then it expands into four more tools and you go, oh my God, there's more tools behind it. At least that's speaking from the writer's perspective.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, I don't believe that computers, they do make our lives quicker and better, but I don't think they are they're a designing tool. They're not the way you design. If that, I don't know, that doesn't make sense, but...
Yeah, they're a tool, they're a means to an end. They're not the end itself.
Exactly. Thank you. As a writer, that was perfectly put.
Yeah, and
thank
also you. One of those phrases that people actually go, oh, that's that makes sense. And then they walk away going, what the hell does that actually mean? Means to an end instead of the end itself.
Yeah.
So any last words of advice for those who would be freelance and those who already are?
It's terrible because I always sell people on freelance. And I'm like, I'm actually shooting myself in the foot because... essentially the competition, right?
I know, I chatted to Lucas yesterday as well. We ended up saying like, okay, actually guys, don't go freelance. Yeah. Especially if you're a writer, anyone listening to this?
Look, I think it does take a very specific personality type to do it and to do it successfully. Not successfully, but to feel happy doing it because you do get isolated to a degree depending on the type of freelancer you are. But you do kind of shut yourself off to a whole bunch of things and people and that sort of thing. But and so long as you can manage your own time, it's cool.
Yeah.
I've done it for 9 years. I've never looked back. I've loved it. I've loved the people I've worked with. I've done better work now than I could have ever done in any agency. And that was one of the things when I decided to go freelance. One of the executive creative directors that I used to work with, who's a very well-known guy that everyone loves, he sat me down and he's like, what are you doing? You're going to work on crap work. You're going to hate it.
Right.
And I walked out of his office and cried in the bathroom for about half an hour. And I was like, screw it. I'm just going to do it anyway. And I'm really glad I did because I've done much better work in better environments that I would never have had the option of doing in any agency.
Right.
It's been great for my career from that perspective. And also I get paid nicely. So
yeah.
In comparison.
Absolutely.
So that's also another key thing. So
because there's a definite ceiling when it comes to being a designer. If you don't go up into the management levels of creative director and so on.
But even if you do.
Even if you do, yeah, absolutely. The creatives are still earning on average way less than anyone on corporate side or anyone in the kind of the money side of things.
Yeah.
But
and it's not that money is everything, but I think what I've found for what I want to do, the balance between money and loving what I do is right for me in freelance.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really want to recommend that everyone listening checks out Kate's website, which is thebutchershop.co.za. I think by having a quick look at what the kind of work Kate does, check out her T's and C's, check out the website in general, and you can just get a kind of, for me, a sense of someone who isn't a part-time, just trying this out creative, someone who has rules, self-respect, boundaries, and is willing to turn away clients who are not right for her or are presenting problems, who trains her clients right from the beginning so that she can work more effectively with them and do better work. So definitely worth checking out. Are there any other asks of my extremely teeny tiny audience? Any recommendations or anything that you would like to recommend that they do?
Like words of wisdom? Because I don't have any.
Okay. Yeah, would you like, basically, since you're not, I mean, should we follow your Instagram account?
I suppose, actually, yeah, why not go have a look at my Instagram account?
Do you post work on that?
I do. Well, I have a separate one for the work.
Okay.
That I haven't posted in a while.
Right.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, sorry, Grey has taken over my life. But yeah, go follow me on Instagram. It'd be nice to have more than a couple of hundred followers.
What's your account's name?
The Butcher's Shop Design.
Okay. At The Butcher's Shop Design.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.